Fabulous. So we're in Ephesians. And yesterday we had that overarching view of the enormous, expansive vision of God, that he is calling all people of every tongue, tribe and nation to one extraordinary family, and that that is because of what Jesus has done, and Jesus is the way, because he has paid the price for us to be part of that family, but that the call of God is always for the other. That God, do you remember, God could have just stayed a three perfect, happy Trinity relationship. It would have been perfect in some ways, but instead he risked everything to go out in creation to create the others, and then has had that constant call. And whatever we've done, be it sin, be it empire, be it kingdom, all these things that may have looked against, he never pressed the reject button. He never pressed the reject button. He's still on course. He's still doing what he's going to do. And he's going to bring others into the eternal family. And we get to play a part in that. So that was a recap. And so this evening, we're going to look at the impossible task. And I want us to read just a little bit of the text first. So we're going to look at the impossible talk. So yesterday was that extraordinary vision and a call whether we're in. Are we in with that vision? Because that's the calling. And this evening, we're going to unpack the impossible task. And we're going to explain a bit more about that in a minute. I'm actually going to read. I'm going to read probably a different bit to what I've got on the screen. Nothing like that, eh? But we are going to read a different bit. I'm going to read from Ephesians chapter 4, starting at verse 17. So I tell you this and insist on it in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their thinking. They're darkened in their understanding. They're separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that's in them due to the hardening of their hearts. Having lost all sensitivity, they've given themselves over to sensuality so as to indulge in every kind of impurity, and they are full of greed. That, however, is not the way of life you've learned when you heard about Christ and were taught in him in accordance with the truth that is in Jesus. You were taught with regard to your former way of life to put off your old self, which is being corrupted by its deceitful desires, to be made new in the attitude of your minds, and to put on the new self, created to be like God in true righteousness and holiness. And there's a whole pile of practical things in here. I'm going to jump to verse 8. For you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light, for the fruit of light consists in all goodness, righteousness, and truth. And find out what pleases the Lord. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Be very careful then how you live. Not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil. Therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. Do not get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit, speaking to one another with psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit. Sing, we've been doing that, and make music from your heart to the Lord, always giving thanks to the God and Father of everything in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. This is a little piece of actually describing this family that we have been called into. The family of God that we've been called into is to be godlike. The calling is to be godlike. It's to be a mirror of what it means to be God in a way, to be godlike and show the world who God is by what we are as the family of God. And that's why, like, the way that we behave really matters. That's why it so matters that we've allowed the Spirit of God, if you like, to turn us inside out. In Ephesians, we're referred to as a building, we're referred to as a family, and we're referred to as a household. And there is this distinct before God and after God, this distinct parallel of what it looks like to not be in the family, and then, if you like, the way the family is. You know when you when I got married, you're bringing two families collide, don't they? Two ways of doing things. And I remember we went on the HTB marriage course, and it just some of the things really made you laugh about the way that people like when they do what you've always done. And then you don't understand why the other person is doing what they don't seem to understand the way to do things. I remember some friends of mine, they'd got married and they got lost one day. It was pre-mobile phones. So one of them did what they always did in their family is they went back to the last place where they'd had a conversation and knew that they'd seen that person. And the other person did what they always do in their family, which is they went back to the car. And then when eventually, I have no idea how eventually they met up. Again, they were like, why did you do? Why did you do? Because they did what they've done because they were part of a family. And being part of the family of God becomes like part of your DNA. It becomes who you are and the way you are and the way that we do things around here. It becomes our culture, the air that we breathe, and it's supposed to be godlike. Godlike. So that when people walk in or when you are out being, people see the difference, don't they? The tangible difference of the living power of being a part of the family of God. And why is this family, who is in this family, particularly for you? I'm going to skip this and this. And that's a recap on yesterday. Remember that great image? This is where I want to be. I'm wondering if I'm in the right. Hang on a minute. We're in the wrong section. Keep going, Rachel. We're going to get there. Here we are. Talk to. That's making more sense. So Jesus, do you remember the passage in Matthew chapter 12, verses 46 onwards. Jesus' mother and brother turn up to try and see Jesus, and he's with the disciples and he's speaking and he's teaching. And his mother and brother come along and people say, oh, your mother and brother are there. You know what he says, don't you? He says, well, you might not know, but some of you might know. He says, who? Who are my mother and brother? Who are my mother and my brothers? He says, whoever does the will of my father, the will of the family, do you see, the will of the father, that's my mother and my brothers. Now, we've probably read that before. There's a level of familiarity. Can you imagine the shock and horror in that culture of what Jesus is saying? So, because the mother and brother, it looks as if maybe Joseph has died. Jesus is the oldest son. He has this huge element of responsibility for his immediate blood family. He's now the leader of that family. And they have come because they need Jesus and they want Jesus probably to sort things out or do something. That's why they've come. And in that culture, that's the way it always is. That family matters. Your brother and your sister, these are your, you know that thing of allegiance? Your allegiance lies down your bloodlines. That's where it lies. This is his mother, his brothers. That's where the allegiance lies. And so they rock up expecting Jesus to drop everything and go with them. Can you imagine the shock when Jesus says, oh, my, who? Who? I mean, if I was his mother, I'd be pretty upset, wouldn't you? What do you mean, who? What do you mean, who? I'm your mother, for goodness sake. Get Jesus out here right now. He's a very naughty boy and I've got a few things I'd like to tell him. I mean, it's actually outrageous. Who? I mean, you're like, oh, all the good I did you. And do you remember that time you got lost in the temple? Oh, goodness gracious. Like, it's outrageous. This statement is outrageous. And he's like, you know, the people who follow the will of my father, they are the people, that is who my brother and sister is. So he suddenly, if you like, he's founding the new family. These people are my brothers and my sisters. And everything that I would have, if you like, owed my allegiance, my fealty to my earth, like my bloodline family, now belongs to the people who are following the will of the Father, and that is who he's redefined the family. He has redefined the family. And then you see this echo, don't we, all the way through the letters of Paul as he's redefined the family. You are a family. You are River Church. You are a family. This, your allegiance, like with this family of people who are following the will of God together, this is your family. This is radical, by the way, in today's culture. These are your brothers and your sisters. Not just in a sort of throwaway comment. My wonderful uncle used to call everybody bro. We loved it. And, you know, but it means more than it really means my brother and my sister and my family. And especially in that culture, do you remember it would have relied your economic unit, your like your status, your even your way to deal with and operate in the world would have been defined by your family and your family's position. All of those things are being radically redefined by Jesus in that one moment. This is your number one place of allegiance. This is your number one, if you like, definition of who you are and why you are alive and what you are doing. It's all been radically rearranged by Jesus. And that is what Paul is talking about here in Ephesians when he's talking about the family of God that we have come into. And then the joy is that this family is always growing. So that's the plan, remember, the others in. So this family is always growing. So we are expecting this family to grow, and we're expecting it to be totally transformative in the culture and community in which we are now living. But there are some challenges for this today. There are some real challenges. So do you remember that the God's possession? The sense of being the possession of God and in the family, we get this head-on collision with the secular individual. Just for a minute, imagine the secular individual. That is, if you like, the push of our culture. And each and every one of us is always being discipled. Whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, it's not that you're not a disciple, it's who's discipling you. Okay? So, and the culture is even still discipling us as Christians. We have to be really aware of it. There's no neutral. So I've heard parents say, well, what we're going to do is let our children grow up, and when they're an adult, they can decide. Oh, you mean they're going to be discipled by the world, and when they get to the age of 18, you're expecting them to flip into an understanding of it? That isn't going to work because they will have been discipled. There isn't a neutral. The world isn't neutral and faith sort of, you know, subjective, and that's objective. There is no objective neutral. Everybody is always being discipled by someone, by something, all of the time. Our job is to make sure that we're being discipled and following Jesus and in the family. But the people outside the church, it's not like they're not being discipled. They're all radically being discipled, and they're being discipled to be a radical secular individual. That is the push. The person who I was talking about this over breakfast, you know, and the ultimate pinnacle might be the one-bedroom flat in London. Why are they only building one- and two-bedroom flats? Have they not thought that anyone else in the world, is there no other model of existence in the middle of London? And so, you know, that's that. But it's the opposite of this. This is the very opposite, how to be the family of God. And this is the polarized opposite. So when we begin this job of evangelism, what happens is we are pulling people in. We are pulling people in to this, who are secular individuals, into the family of God. And there is this mighty, mighty world clash. Mighty world clash. Let's have a little look at some of the things about secular individualism. So we're going to just do a few quotes. This is, you know, useful advice for the secular individual. Putting yourself first is not selfish, quite the opposite. You must put your happiness and health first before you can be of help to anyone else. I'm God, and anyone who wants to disagree, I'm the God of me. You can't tell me who I am. Interesting. This is actually a quote. The top one isn't Kelly Armstrong's advice for life. This is more a quote from one of her novels. But was it wrong to put yourself first? That's called survival, right? If you're running for your life, you don't get the luxury of being nice. And how about this one? This is advice for life. You are the center of your universe, and you can make anything happen. That one, you can hear that one, can't you? You've heard that one. You are the center of your universe and you can make anything happen. Can you see any clash here? Worldview problems? What are some of the assumptions? That your happiness must come first. This is really common. So when we go out and we do evangelism, I talk to people, I ask them, what are you looking for in life? What's your meaning for life? What's your philosophy for life? Happiness regularly comes up. I just want to be happy. That's a common thought. I just want to be happy. Your well-being is completely separate from other people, as if the choices I make are independent. They're all about me and they'll have no impact on anybody else. And even if they do, that's that person's problem. My choice, me, and if I have a choice that impacts someone else, that they need to deal with that. The well-being of your family or community isn't the priority. You are. And that you have no obligations to anyone else that would override your own desires. So if we start with these premises, can you see why this concept, this beautiful vision of the family of God, and we're starting with secular individuals who have a level of, it's something even Leslie Newbegin picked up about this sense of anonymity that we are creating in individuals. And yet we know where this is taking people. This is the opposite. So if we look at what God had in mind and we look at what the culture is shouting at people to be, when they get there, they find they are anxious because they've got to sort it out for themselves. They're depressed, they're lonely, they're broken. They're trying to keep their, you know, it all together and they cannot. And so again, this is what I'm hearing, this concept, like when you're talking to people, they're like, I need a framework for life because this is actually bankrupt. What they've been sold is bankrupt. The loneliness, the isolation, the be your own God leaves you actually in a really broken place. And that's why at the moment there is this pulling in to find something else. But then as we bring these individuals, the others in, to the family of God, think how much relearning it's going to take for them to become part of God's family. Let's have a look at some of the clashes that we're up for. So, God's possession, don't you even love the word possession? How counter is that to that sentence of I'm my own God? God's possession versus a secular individual. So God has authority. Oh, we have trouble with that word. We love autonomy. I am my own authority. Hierarchy. Oh, we've got real trouble with hierarchy because if only I'm in charge, I don't really want anyone else's. Again, that sense of autonomy. I am my own, you know, I am my own authority and my own. I just don't like that word of hierarchy. You know, you can feel the reaction. Unity. Well, not at the cost of my individualism. Thank you. I don't wish to conform. I want to. I am an individual, and that comes first. So why would I lay anything down of my individuality or my choices to make something better for the united? You know, for the unity of this group of people. We're like the promise and the sense of covenant. God is all about promise and covenant. And as we've seen, how many times could he have said, "I'm out"? You've broken your part, I'm out. And what we see modeled by Father God is that God has never pushed the button and said, you've broken it. You've broken the covenant, I'm off. He never says that. It's not in his vocab. He says, you've broken the covenant, I'll come and fix it and pay the price for you. Oh, that's really different, isn't it? You broke the covenant, I'll pay the price for that brokenness. It's completely opposite. So that promise and the covenant on his side is extraordinary. But we have a commitment phobic secular individual. Oh, I don't know. That's a bit of a big one. I don't know if I want to make that kind of promise. You know, we might be able to commit for 3 to 5 years at a time, perhaps on a good day, to any given person, location, job, activity, hobby, anything. We wouldn't want to forecast that for too long because we've got we're a bit nervous about commitment. It's the absolute opposite of God's way of committing. The individual versus the family. A family only works, doesn't it? When we lay down our individualism and we work for the good of the whole. This is a concept that we just don't have anymore. How do we work for the good of the whole? So as a church family, you're being called to lay down your individual rights for the good of the whole. Pretty scary. And so people really struggle with that. And then the secularism versus the work of the Spirit of God. The work of the Spirit of God is just life-giving, and people are desperate for something other than themselves. And yet, you know, the secular thing is just, it's devoid of that. You've actually just got to sort of sort it out yourself. Sort it out yourself in that framework of what you've been given. How about holiness and purity? So much of the choices that people make are actually just impure. They're not holy. They're not about being called out to be a holy people. And how much of that do we just sort of let creep in into ourselves? It creeps in. We're like, well, you know. So things like some of the programs that we watch may have been considered pornography 30 years ago. But we don't recognize that now because the cultural shift has drifted so far, we may not even see it. It's like, you know, what those creep, you kind of slowly warm up the water and they don't get out. I think the church, we've lost some of our holiness and purity because the water around us has warmed up so much and we never got out. And we didn't notice the temperature gauge on things like holiness. And so we've accepted way too many things that we shouldn't. And things like pornography, it's so readily available and it's a curse actually not just outside, but inside the church. And then generosity, and we could put greed, or I could put consumerism. We don't realise. I think some of this is examining. Like I need to re-examine my life on, you know, the coffee that I want, at the time that I want it, in the way that I want it, in the style that I want it, in the cup that I want it, in the coffee shop that I want it. Thank you. Perfect. You know, isn't it bizarre? But that sort of. That's become acceptable. And you think about Wesley, who fixed his salary and lived, and when he died, did they have like a silver spoon or something left? I mean, there was just nothing left. Everything else went to the kingdom. Everything else. He died on the money that he needed probably for the week. Everything else went into the kingdom call. And he set his salary, and everything else was God's. We have an amazing person who helps fund Hope Together. And what they did is he prayed to the Lord about his company. He said, Lord, if you bless me, everything else I'm going to give. And he stayed by that. They don't have shareholders. They have a trust for mission. It's staggeringly beautiful. And he just lives a normal life. He doesn't have a jet. He could way have a jet, but he doesn't because he's not been trapped in the consumerism or the greed of our culture. He's really beautifully generous. And it's, so who are we going to be shaped by? Who are we going to be shaped by? And you might go, oh, I can really see this in the culture out there. But if we're going to be effective at bringing others in, we need to model this radical family that is countercultural. And I know you are very good at family here. You were really good. I can hear it. I've been chatting away about people going on holiday. But you might have to like turn this up a notch. How do you do? I don't know how many times you've had to forgive each other. And if you think, oh, no, everyone here's so nice. You don't know each other well enough yet. And you know each other pretty well. Do you see what I mean? So if you're not regularly having to forgive one another, you may not actually be doing this deep enough. Because you need to be forgiving each other regularly. And that will show a level, actually, that you are really, you're really in this together. And then, the thing is, there's two challenges here. One is how much of the culture has got into us and how much of a God-shaped family are we? And where do we need, you know, who can say no to you? When it comes to authority and when it comes to godliness and holiness, who can say no to you? Think of the Methodist class groups that had a real level of openness and honesty on some of these difficult things. Who can say, you might have it, but who else in the church says to you, I'm really not sure you should be spending your money that way? We're a bit British, aren't we? But that level of accountability, who sees your bank balance in this church? Do other people see, you know, where is that? So is there that level of transparency? I'm not, you know, but there is a level of transparency in the kingdom of God that is quite extraordinary. And I'm not saying I want like the concept of heavy shepherding. Many of you remember that. But that's not what we're here for. We're not saying that all the money goes into Adam's bank account and we just trust him to do the best. That's not what I'm... yeah. That's not what I'm saying. But a level of transparency together of what it really means to be this family. So how much of all that you are. And I've heard amazing stories of people who stayed. And how do we make the decisions of staying or going? Who can say, I don't think you should leave? You know, I think you should stay. Who are we? So there's this level of what, and we don't know how to do this. I feel like it's what we're all grappling with in churches at the moment is how to, we've got so much of the culture that we've adopted that we haven't even realized that we don't actually know actually how to model the family of God in the way that we're going to need it to help disciple the people who are coming in. Does that make sense? So I know we're grappling with it as a church. What does this look like? It can't look like everybody in a one-bedroom flat coming together on Sunday for an hour and a half. I mean, we can all just about cope with an hour and a half. You're doing well on a weekend. I'm sure some people have annoyed you a little bit. Just a little bit this weekend. You're getting closer. Do you see? But we don't really know because of course we can cope with an hour and a half on a Sunday just about. I mean, amazingly, people do still fall out, don't they? I don't know how. But anyway, do you see? But like, and so we live a bit in community. That's always entertaining. And that's, I just wonder who else, I was discussing this with another church group and they said, oh, it really got to grips when people walked in, opened the fridge and ate the food. You know what? So we struggle a bit like that because, you know, we try to share food in our house. It's like, you know, you might have bought a special trifle. Yeah, exactly. The teenager's eating the trifle. We live with 20-somethings just as likely to eat the trifle. But you know, the person is worth more than the trifle. My parents were very good at modelling. So I remember my father lending his car to someone else in our church, well, to a different church family, but one that was closely associated. And the guy came back and he'd reversed it up the drive and he gave my dad the keys. He says, oh, I'm so sorry. We had a bit of an accident. And there's this mega scratch mark down the car. And then he handed my father the keys and then he left. And I'm like, well, like you borrowed the car, you've scrunchled the car, and you haven't like, you kind of done a vague apology, but you haven't sorted it out. Surely you'd say, I'm so sorry, I'll take it to the garage, I'll fix that for you. Whatever, you know, I could pay for the repairs. And I remember my dad then reflecting on me. He said, well, the relationship with that person is worth more than the car. And I know another father who sold his posh car because he couldn't trust it to other people. And he thought, if I can't trust it to other people, then I shouldn't have that car. So he got rid of his really smart car so that he could just lend a car and not worry about the stresses. I remember buying a cream sofa. And who thought that was a good idea? And then I remember the first home group night of this cream sofa. And one of the guys who came around, he wasn't very good at cleanliness. And so he comes in and he goes, whoa, and he sits on the cream sofa and he picks up the big cream cushion and he hugs it. And I'm like, great, gonna have to clean the sofa. But like, he's more important than the sofa, isn't he? Wait, it doesn't matter, Rachel. Anyway, the covers go in the wash, so hallelujah for that. But like, it's like examining our lives on how are we gonna let others in? Now, I'm not saying have no boundaries because we don't want everybody burnt out. So actually, you can do that accountably with other people who might say to you, actually, Rachel, that person who's got a door key for your house now and has been emptying the fridge on a daily basis, you might not actually be helping them because they're not learning habits of how to, as it says in the Bible, get a job and be generous to others. Everyone is supposed to work to be able to be generous. You're not supposed to work to be able to look after yourself. Very clear in Scripture, you're supposed to work so that you can be generous to the household and family of God. It's a really interesting perspective. So that's my questions to you. How close are you, really? Who has access to the fridge, access to what's on your phone? Who can say no to you? Access to your front door and access to your wealth. Like, you know, that access to all areas. I know it should God, but how does that work out as church family? And why do we need to be this radical? Because there is a huge wave of people who are secular individuals who are going to come and join your church. And when they arrive, they're going to bring everything from over here in here. Isn't that going to be fun? And they're not going to know how to behave in your church. And they're going to need loads of love and forgiveness. And you know the thing they're going to need most? Is reparenting. I look around this room, you've got a wealth. And some of you are like, oh my word, they only just moved out. The actual children. And you are telling me, I've now got to start parenting another generation. Yes. Because that's the allegiance to the king. And do you know what? We have a whole generation of young people and young adults who are desperately in need of parenting. They need to come into this family and they need parents. And I want to ask you, how much do you want those others in? Do you remember, like in the war, everyone had to just take in the refugees that came out of London? And can you imagine standing there and someone saying, how many can you take? Oh, yeah, we've got three. We'll take three. We'll take five. Can you imagine the disruption of those children arriving in those homes? That's what I want you to imagine about what's happening right now. Right now, your opportunity in mission. How many will you take? How many will you take? So you need to grow as this beautiful family. Take it even further for the sake of this generation. And you need to be honest in your heart and life about how many others you think you can take. And be prepared for the ride of your lives as you parent the secular individuals and help them to follow and end up as apprentices of Jesus.